A radical transformation of Cleveland from its riverfront to its downtown to its lakefront will be funded with a new taxing district approved this week by Cleveland City Council. Mayor Justin Bibb, who proposed the plan, sang its praises during a State of the City address Thursday. The state of the city in the coming days? Crowded, as the NCAA Women's Final Four leads to the April 8th eclipse and the undefeated Guardians home opener. Welcome to the Sound of Ideas Reporters Roundtable. I'm Mike McIntyre. Will the Browns remain downtown or play in a domed stadium in Brook Park? Team owners Jimmy and Dee Haslam added fuel to that conversation this week. Other news we'll discuss, a Cuyahoga County grand jury indicted former Ohio House Speaker Larry Householder on state charges in the first energy bribery scandal. He's now serving federal time. Ugly concrete traffic barriers bisecting Cleveland's public square are being removed, and Cleveland City Council calls for a ceasefire in Gaza. First news. It's the Sound of Ideas Reporters Roundtable from IdeaStream Public Media. I'm Mike McIntyre. Thank you so much for joining us. Cleveland City Council has given the green light for a tax increment financing district for downtown. The plan is to divert taxes from increased property values to fund improvements for the city's river and lakefronts. Even as the TIF was being approved, the owners of the Browns, Jimmy and Dee Haslam, raised the possibility of a new stadium with a dome being built in Brook Park. The option it has been discussing with Cleveland leaders is a mostly publicly funded renovation of the existing lakefront stadium. Concrete barriers placed along the newly renovated public square after the Republican National Convention have been finally removed. Mayor Justin Bibb made a point of noting that in his State of the City address Thursday. The ugly barriers exit just as the city prepares to welcome big crowds for the Women's College Basketball Final Four, the NCAA Final Four, and Eclipse Chasers. And after months of protests, Cleveland City Council this week approved a ceremonial ceasefire resolution for an end to violence in Gaza. So joining me to talk about all of this week's news in studio, IdeaStream's supervising producer of newscasts, Glenn Forbes, and reporter Abigail Botar. Good to have both of you here.
Good morning, Mike.
Good morning.
Good morning. And in Columbus, State House News Bureau reporter Joe Ingles is joining us. Boy, it's so hard to not say Bureau Chief Karen Kassler because it's like imprinted on my brain. But we get the benefit of having Joe's insights today. Joe, welcome.
Thank you.
Very good to have you. We don't take calls on the Friday Roundtable, but please do send us your thoughts on any of our topics. You send the email to soi@ideastream.org. If you'd rather, you can find us on X, formerly Twitter, at Sound of Ideas, and tweet right there. All right, let's get ready to roundtable. Cleveland City Council gave its unanimous approval this week to Mayor Justin Bibb's plan to create a special taxing district to fund redevelopment of downtown and the city's waterfronts. The mayor's administration says the shore-to-core-to-shore tax increment financing district is expected to bring in $3.3 billion to $7.5 billion over the next 40 years. Taxes, except those going to schools, would be plowed back into development. Cleveland will begin borrowing to make massive infrastructure investments with the hope that development creates more revenue down the line. Glenn, City Council originally was resistant because it wanted half of the proceeds to go to neighborhoods immediately. Eventually, they struck a deal where it was going to be 35%, but somewhere down the line because the money needs to be plowed into the center district first. Council eventually just got on board.
Yeah, they unanimously approved it. And as you mentioned, it was several weeks ago that Council President Blaine Griffin and Mayor Justin Bibb said, came out with a statement, it's 35%. That is not codified, however. That's not a final figure.
For the neighborhoods.
For the neighborhoods, correct. It just kind of seems like this is an agreement to move forward. Like this is kind of a ballpark figure where, okay, we kind of agree that it should be around 35% of the profits, I guess you could say, or what's left over after they finish paying for the for these buildings or this development, I should say, downtown. But that is not yet set in stone. So what you hear a lot from council and from the mayor's finance people is it's riskier to do nothing, right? We might as well. We've got to do something here. Let's do this. Even if it's not perfect what everybody wants, it's riskier to not do anything. We've got to move forward with something.
That's something that Kerry McCormack, the downtown councilman, said. It's more risky to not do anything. Chris Harsh, another council member, said that it was necessary to do this because he wanted the city to stop managing decline. It's time to get on the offensive.
I think that's interesting that he used those terms. And they also looked at Columbus and Cincinnati as other areas that have created these kind of larger TIF districts, tax increment funding. You're relying on property taxes to go up. And if property taxes go up, if you build it, they will come, essentially, is the motto here. And as those property taxes go up, more people come downtown for whatever it is that they're going to build, you know, commercial, residential, retail, all that stuff.
Well, they'll do the infrastructure. The developers will build that stuff.
The infrastructure first. We're talking about, you know, the land bridge and things of that nature. So that is kind of the sentiment that even though the neighborhoods are struggling in order to get that money eventually for the neighborhoods, and again, we're talking down the line, they've got to create something, they've got to build a tax base. The other point that the BIB administration made is coming out of COVID, needs have changed, right? You don't have a bunch of people coming down here. It's not necessarily an office culture anymore. You need to create kind of this entertainment culture or you know, green space, of course, is the other thing that they're talking about. And so coming out of COVID, people's priorities have changed, and they need to take advantage of that.
We had a really great discussion here on The Sound of Ideas where people were questioning, one, that risk element, where if the property taxes don't go up and if the money doesn't come, then you're stuck with having to pay all this money that you've borrowed. But in addition to that, the money that would have gone to the County Public Library, Tri-C, the Metro Parks, and Health and Human Services in Cuyahoga County would be diverted. That's the money that's going into this. And there are a lot of folks that are saying that those organizations are going to be hurt by this.
There's been this push and pull between the city and the county recently. We've seen it with police detail, right, with the sheriff's deputies getting more on downtown detail and things like that. And so there's a push and pull kind of from both sides, even though County Executive Chris Ronayne says as downtown, we need a thriving downtown, essentially, to have a thriving Cuyahoga County. City Council did not host county leaders. At least one council member had requested that they hear from some of these leaders of county agencies that stand to lose money to the district. But again, it's just kind of this, you know, push and pull. Where's the money going to go? Who's going to claim it? And what's it going to be used for?
Big project that's going to be part of this, the infrastructure that is needed for it would be paid for with this TIF money, is the Cleveland Clinic and the Cavaliers, who announced this week much more detail on something we'd heard several months ago, and soon groundbreaking on a facility right along the Cuyahoga River.
Yeah, this is interesting. The Cavaliers have been in Independence. They've had their practice facility, I should say, in Independence for quite a while. Right now, the plan is to move back downtown, groundbreaking potentially at the end of this year, open in the year 2027. And this is a joint venture with the Cleveland Clinic, think sports medicine. They call it the Global Peak Performance Center, but, you know, sports medicine, nutrition, other wellness services. So this is the Cavaliers and the Cleveland Clinic teaming up with Bedrock Properties, which is the real estate arm of Cavs owner Dan Gilbert's enterprise, if you will. And so the Cavaliers would move their practice facility. They would be based here in the city of Cleveland, and it would be this very large complex right near Tower City. The Bedrock, I should mention, controls 35 acres of that riverfront property. And there's further plans for that, too. Again, retail, residential, commercial.
So that's Cavaliers. Let's shift over then to the Cleveland Browns professional sports team, football. Owners Jimmy and Dee Haslam this week raised the possibility of building a new dome stadium in Brook Park. We've been talking about that for weeks. They finally mentioned it at the NFL meetings and said, yeah, that's a possibility. They have an option to buy a 176-acre parcel of land. Made the comments during this annual NFL meeting in Orlando. They've been negotiating with Cleveland about public funding for a massive renovation of the existing lakefront stadium. So one of the questions was, well, is this just part of a negotiating ploy? Well, yeah, everything is. If you say we have no other options now, give us what we want, that's not going to work. So there is another option. But it also appears to be something that's a viable option.
Right now, the Haslams say they have two equally attractive options, basically, is what they're saying. They, as you mentioned, they do have this option to purchase the land in Brook Park. They push back Dee Haslam, wife of Jimmy. They own the Browns, of course. They say they don't like that characterization, right, that it's a negotiating tactic or a negotiating ploy. Dee says, we've worked really well with the mayor. We've been transparent the whole time. We're in constant contact with both his team, and they both want what is best for Cleveland.
Yeah.
So I think this is an interesting, I mean, we've been talking about this for the last several weeks when the Northeast Ohio Transit blog and Kenny Prendergast kind of came out with this news that they have the option to purchase this land. And what it is, Mike, football village, more more land controlled by the Haslams, opportunities for hotels, opportunities for, you know, Browns related, could be team Hall of Fame there, things like that, close to the airport. And the way Kenny
parking,
the way Kenny Prendergast put it to me was, imagine you fly in to Hopkins, it's the dead of winter, it's cold, you never have to go outside, right? Mm. You take this transit over to this football village, you're in the hotel, you're in the dome. So that is one option to create kind of this football village. The other option is about $1 billion, they say, to renovate the waterfront, the, you know, the lakefront stadium. $2 billion to create this dome in this football village area.
Clearly, if that happens, the city of Cleveland will pay none of that because it's not going to happen in the city of Cleveland. So the negotiation is, do you want to keep the Browns downtown and on the lakefront for 8 events a year? Or is it better, and this is something that Dee Haslam brought up, she said, don't look at it just as a negative. If the Browns were to move to Brook Park, now you have all of this space to do something transformative on the lakefront. So it's interesting. It's kind of played both ways. The city is saying, we want to do this land bridge. We want the Browns Stadium to be part of this new redevelopment. But on the other hand, if it was gone, think of what you could do.
Yeah, and I mean, there is a lot of land there. You kind of have two, let me say, seldom used properties there. When you talk about Burke Lakefront Airport and Brown Stadium, they've found a way to get more events into Brown Stadium. Concerts, there's a big wrestling event coming this summer, you know, that's going to draw a lot of people and that kind of thing. But yeah, it's tough when you're on the lakefront and you live in Cleveland, it's tough to use an outdoor stadium of that size, you know, that many times. Let me ask you a quick question, Mike, because you've been covering this for a long time.
Yeah.
This waterfront development, does it feel like it's closer now? Because we've been talking about waterfront development forever, okay?
No,
it doesn't.
No, to be a jaded longtime Clevelander, you would say, every time a new idea is brought up, it's exciting, sparkly, new, and now you get to the point where you say, let's just see it. And so when we see it, yeah, that'll be great. But for now, it's another great plan. We'll see.
Well said.
As we exit this conversation, though, let me, you know what, we'll just leave that there. We'll leave the Browns stadium there. We're going to continue to cover that, certainly. I do want to shift over to the city of Akron, though, and get Abigail involved in our conversation. Black elected officials of Summit County wants the city of Akron to pause its search for a new police chief. Chief Steve Milet retired earlier this year, and the city initially started a nationwide search. But a few weeks ago, Mayor Shamus Malik said the city instead would focus on an internal candidate, citing a legal technicality. That could limit the diversity in the pool, according to the Black Elected Officials Organization. Abigail, the group wants the Ohio Attorney General to weigh in on the legality of the of whether or not you can just look at an internal candidate. They want to get that solved, and then what?
Right. So the idea they proposed in this letter that they released this week to the city would be having the attorney general weigh in. If the attorney general says city law trumps state law, that's okay. So right now, the way that it stands, just to clarify, is state law says that it would be illegal to hire an external candidate. And the city law, which could trump that, is kind of ambiguous. It says that that the city should fill roles in the police department internally as long as it's practical. And so Malik's administration determined that that wasn't strong enough language to give them the power to hire an external candidate. So what this the Black elected officials group was proposing was to have the attorney general weigh in. If he says you can hire an external candidate, then they would say that the city should, again, open up a nationwide search to diversify the pool of candidates they have. But if the attorney general says, no, you're correct, the way that the law states right now, you have to look internally, then this group wants the city to put a more permanent pause on it to pass a charter amendment, which would give the city more explicit power to hire an external candidate. So hold off on hiring the police chief for however long it takes to put that on the ballot. I think they're aiming for November. So put a pause on that until the charter amendment could, be passed, and then do an external search again.
So does this mean that this organization believes there isn't a suitable candidate that's already in the police department? What's driving this?
So the letter talked a lot about systemic racism in the department and how that has caused there to be a lack of qualified Black candidates. The way they like laid out some numbers in the letter, they said that the department only has one Black captain, one Black lieutenant, and 9 Black sergeants in a department of more than 400 officers. And the way they have to like look at hiring it is by like what level you are, like captain above lieutenant. And so that would mean that there would only be like maybe one Black candidate, and they talked about how there are other underrepresented minorities in there as well, like women, etc., and how there are systemic issues in the Akron Police Department that have led it to be this way. And so they had a quote in the letter about how they were really hoping this could be a time of change in the Akron Police Department, and how they feel kind of disappointed that internally this kind of seems like it's going to lead to having another white police chief, because there simply aren't qualified Black candidates in the police department, in their opinion.
What was the city's response to this letter?
So they gave me a short statement last night. They said they received it, that they're reviewing it, and they thank the group for sharing its thoughts. And they said that they'll put out a further statement in response when they finished their review. But it appears, I mean, last we heard from the mayor when he announced the shift in hiring to only looking internally, he said the city is still on track to hire an internal candidate, potentially with a decision coming this spring. So as far as we know, that's still the plan.
All right. Moving back to Cleveland, Mayor Justin Bibb had his State of the City yesterday. Interestingly, Glenn, what we just talked about, Cleveland Browns Stadium, he didn't mention, although he did mention afterward he'd love to have the Browns stay in Cleveland. They're continuing the negotiations. But he did say it's time for Cleveland to regain its confidence, Cleveland the city, as he highlighted a number of accomplishments and laid out his ambitions. It was his third State of the City speech at the Mimi, Ohio Theater at Playhouse Square was the venue. Glenn, the TIF we talked about earlier was part of his speech as well. The mayor was on a roll. He had a good week. He had the TIF be approved. He had the barriers removed from Public Square. It was a pretty good week. The resolution that was passed at City Council, it took a little bit of the steam out of some of the protests that have been happening about City Council's stance on the war with Hamas, the Israel-Hamas war. So all of those things, he was able to stand up and talk about some
development. You could tell he was energized yesterday, right? He had a lot of, in his mind, of course, he had a lot of good things to talk about. He talked about waterfront development, and I think he was feeling confident, and that's why he said, hey, it's time for the city to get their confidence back. And, you know, not only that, he did mention, of course, as you said, the Browns Stadium. He said consistent communication with the Browns and has them in the last 2 years. He said he can't comment specifically on this as they're in the middle of negotiations. But yeah, the mayor certainly seemed to be in a good and energetic mood yesterday. And I think, as you said, he got some momentum going before this speech.
We talked a little earlier about the tension between neighborhoods and downtown with the development and that money that's going to come in. Bibb said, independent of that TIF, he hears people of the neighborhoods, and specifically the southeast side of Cleveland, where he's from, and talked about major projects that are planned there.
Yeah, they've got $15 million already dedicated to that area, and they're also seeking proposals to redevelop 3 city-owned properties in the Lee Harvard neighborhood, including the former JFK and Gracemont school sites. So, you know, the cities and the counties, but in this case, of course, the city, they're going to put out these requests for proposals. They want to get this blight, taken care of. They want more development in there. And incrementally, when they can do it, they're going to look to do it. So that was, again, another kind of piece of momentum for the mayor to kind of keep rolling and say, hey, it's not all about downtown.
It was shocking to hear a mayor say that the state of their city is strong, or other positive words.
You know, it's funny because my son was asking me about the state of the city yesterday, and I won't share everything that I told him, but it was like, you know, they talk about what their accomplishments are, and they try to paint a very rosy picture,
and
right?
Like I said, he had a good week, and things are going well. And the mayor in Lorain, Jack Bradley, also things are going well in Lorain.
The state of our city is strong.
It's always strong.
Yes.
What was interesting to hear, and one of the things that he did talk about, was the crime statistics and how they appear to be improving. However, staffing still low for the police department. He mentioned that the current class of cadets for police, something like 52, I think it's 52 members, that is more than the last 4 classes combined, which really tells you the kind of desert of applications that they've been experiencing over the last 4 years.
Yeah, he says applications are up 45%. You mentioned the size of the class, and, you know, one thing that Mayor Bibb is going to talk about frequently is the way he raised the incentives, raising pay for cadets, making it easier for younger officers to move up in the ranks, making it easier for those with military or other law enforcement backgrounds to get in and move up. But yeah, a lot of it comes down to pay, the pay that he has been able to increase for those cadets and working with city council to raise pay for rank and file officers as well. So they believe that, along with taking off some of the restrictions about, you know, facial hair or baseball caps or whatever, is helping getting more people in the door and getting more people interested in this, in police work in the city.
All right, last thing on State of the City was schools. And he noted the new leader in the Cleveland schools that decisions are going to be made with students in mind, but did signal that some tough decisions are coming, specifically as it relates to schools and the footprint of the school district.
Right, nothing specific, but when you hear phrases like hard and necessary choices, and not wanting to keep up with aging buildings, excuse me, and also the fact that, you know, the, Cleveland's population used to be triple of what it was, and they have to kind of right-size their footprint with some of these buildings. So when you hear those phrases, even though there's nothing specific, it certainly seems like those hard and necessary choices could include closures in the future.
All right. Daryl has an email asking about the stadium discussion we had. He said, can't a dome be built at the current location and tie it into the I think he says conversation center, but I think he meant convention center. He said that would be synergy. It's a long tie-in from the convention center to Brown Stadium. But just to answer that question, the Haslams say no, that you can't put a dome.
Yeah, one, there is some distance there between the convention center and the stadium. But the way the previous stadium was built, and again, Mike, you know this very well, going back to 1999 and the late 90s, it was rushed. They put the stadium kind of in the same place. They cut some corners. It's a cookie-cutter design, very difficult. Again, all the studies from team owners have showed it's very difficult to put a dome or a retractable roof on that current facility.
And the team owners also noted Burke Lakefront Airport and FAA situations in regards to that as well.
Right, so, and here's Burke Lakefront Airport again. We always have to talk about it.
Indeed. All right, we're going to take a quick break right now, though. When we come back, we're going to talk about some statehouse news, including new charges filed by a Cuyahoga County grand jury against former Ohio House Speaker Larry Householder. And we will be right back right after this. It's the Sound of Ideas Reporters Roundtable. I'm Mike McIntyre. Welcome back to the Sound of Ideas Reporters Roundtable from IdeaStream Public Media. I'm Mike McIntyre, joined this week by Abigail Botar and Glenn Forbes from IdeaStream here with me in studio, and Joe Ingles from the Statehouse News Bureau. Before we get back to the roundtable, let me remind you about the IdeaStream News Quiz, which you can find now at ideastream.org/quiz. Feel free to click the button after you take the quiz to be notified when it drops each week. I got my email this morning. If you listen closely to the roundtable today, you'll have most, if not all, of the answers. And when you get all the answers right, it just makes your day, like getting Wordle in three guesses or less, right? So do check out the quiz. Here's going to be something I'm pretty sure is on the quiz. A Cuyahoga County grand jury has indicted former Ohio House Speaker Larry Householder on state charges related to the First Energy HB6 bribery scandal in the federal trial that landed Householder in federal prison. Ohio Attorney General Dave Yost announced the charges this week. Let's talk a little bit about that, Joe. These charges go beyond the bribery stuff that was the focus of the federal trial and actually accuses him of improperly using campaign funds to pay for his defense.
Yeah, it improperly, they say that he improperly used those campaign funds for things like remodeling his house in Florida, paying off personal debts, using it for other things that campaign funds cannot be used for.
But in addition, these particular charges are that he paid the lawyers for the federal trial using campaign funds, which they're saying is absolutely out of bounds.
Exactly. Exactly. You're not allowed to do that at all. And, you know, the state charges go beyond what the federal charges had. You know, the federal charges were basically the bribery, the racketeering, those things. These state charges are configured in a different way with different felonies that could make a big difference if Householder, who is asking He's wanting an he's making an appeal to the court, asking to get out of those federal charges. If he were to get out of those federal charges, these state charges are different and could kick in.
It's one count of theft in office, which is a felony one. There's two counts of aggravated theft, a count of telecommunications fraud, a count of money laundering, five counts of tampering with records. It's a lot there. One of the motivations behind this, it appears, and Dave Yost mentioned this, is that a state conviction would bar Householder from ever holding public office again.
Yeah, there's a law on the state books that says if you're convicted of a felony offense that you cannot go back and be in the state house again and hold any public office, actually. So the reason that that's important is you've got to remember that Larry Householder was the Speaker of the House in the early 2000s. And then he kind of left in 2006. There was this cloud of suspicion around him that he may have done something wrong in that first term, but there were never any charges, so that kind of went away. Then he turns around, he comes back about 10 years later, a little more than 10 years later, he comes back, he's Speaker of the House again. And that's when all of this stuff with HB 6 blew up. So, you know, the fear is that he could make a third comeback, you know, or a second comeback, you know, a third term. And so, Yost is saying, hey, if he's convicted of these charges, it will stick. He can't come back.
The foreperson of the grand jury who signed the indictment, Glenn, is Cleveland labor leader Dave Wondolowski, very politically connected. What I didn't understand this is there was some speculation. I saw a story on Cleveland.com where they talked to some legal experts and said, wait a minute, he has been with an organization that he's very politically connected. He's given money to Householder.
Yep.
He actually campaigned for HB 6. And I thought to myself, wait, wouldn't it be a conflict if he campaigned against it? I don't know. But the fact of the matter is that he's so familiar and was on the grand jury. There are some questions being raised about that.
There are plenty of questions being raised about it. And what's interesting about this is if there is some challenge by Householder's attorneys, that might take some of the veil off this very secretive, you know, grand jury process. Wondolowski is the foreperson of the jury, so he did sign that indictment. One of the experts that you mentioned that they talked to did say that it's possible he recused himself from the actual vote, but did then sign that indictment. It is unusual, according to the experts they spoke to see someone so directly involved, be someone so directly involved previously to the crime in question, as having a vote potentially on the grand jury. So it is something that Householder's attorneys could look at. It's a little awkward. The optics aren't great, and there could be some questions, as you've said. I think there are already some questions about this process and Dave Wondolowski's role.
All right. We will obviously keep an eye on that as well. Should Ohio's term limits for state lawmakers be loosened or perhaps eliminated? House Speaker Jason Stevens and Senate President Matt Huffman have said recently they support softening Ohio's term limit laws. Voters approved term limits for Ohio House and Senate lawmakers through a constitutional amendment in 1992. Joe, there's no formal effort underway. There's not anything proposed at this moment, but Stevens and Huffman both are on a collision course for speakership due to term limits. I wonder if that's a motivating factor for what we're hearing now.
You think? yeah, it's probably one motivator. But, you know, they've been talking about this for a while. You know, the lawmakers really hate term limits for the most part. But the problem is, as you pointed out, there's first of all, there's no mechanism to put this on the ballot, and voters would have to change it because it's in the Constitution. There's no effort underway to do that, and it probably wouldn't be on the ballot this year anyway. And next year, who knows who the Speaker of the House is going to be, because as you alluded to, House Speaker Jason Stevens is probably going to be challenged by the current Senate President Matt Huffman, who's follow me here. He's flipping over to the House to be in the House now, because this is what they often do. They flip back and forth from, you know, chambers. And he's flipping over there. So that could cause, we don't know who's going to be in charge. But that's the bottom line.
So that's what's interesting. We do have term limits here, but the way it's worked around is you are a senator for a couple of terms, then you're a representative, then you go back and become a senator. It doesn't seem to actually be term limits anyway.
Right.
So what's interesting, too, is when you see people run for office, they talk about how everyone's a career politician and they need to beat them because they need to get into office and have fresh new eyes. And then once they get in, they want to stay forever.
Right, right. And that's the way it goes down there. There are a lot of people who do that and flip-flop back and forth. Some take a break and sit out for a bit and then come back. But most of them, you know, they do go back and forth, or they go from that to another, you know, another office somewhere.
All right. Thank you, Joe, for keeping an eye on the State House for us. Let's keep an eye on Cleveland City Council right now. It passed a resolution Monday that calls for a ceasefire in Gaza. For the past 5 months, council has refused to take action on the resolution despite pro-Palestinian protests at every single council meeting. And Abigail, the change in direction by council occurred the day that the United Nations Security Council took action.
Right. So like you said, protesters have been attending Cleveland City Council for meetings for months, calling on them to pass the ceasefire resolution. And then on Monday, the United Nations Security Council passed a resolution calling for a ceasefire. And that was the turning point. And Cleveland City Council followed suit and passed a similar resolution.
What was interesting is Council President Blaine Griffin said he wanted council to be in line with the U.S. stance, the federal government stance. But the U.S. didn't vote for this. The U.S. abstained with the U.N. and allowing the vote to happen. But it's interesting that what council had been doing, which is nothing, is what the U.S. decided to do.
It's like a little tricky, like a U.S. abstention, since they so typically veto these things to protect Israel, which is a U.S. ally. Their action of abstaining is, in a way, a vote for it, even though they didn't vote for it. And so in Griffin's eyes, that means that city council's then aligned with the stance of the federal government, which also feels confusing because there's lots of people in the federal government that have lots of different opinions. It's not like the U.S. came out in support of a ceasefire, really, but I don't know. That was the turning point for them.
How have the demonstrators reacted to this move? Because you would think, okay, celebration, you guys are finally on our side, and that's not how it went.
No, yeah, I feel like it never is. They'll say there's always more work to be done. So we saw pictures while the resolution was adopted. People were holding up signs that said 40,000 people too late, which references the number of Palestinians killed in the war. The health ministry in Gaza reports more than 32,000 Palestinians have been killed. And then during public comment at that meeting Monday, people said that they're now going to shift their attention to calling on the city to divest from any dealings or financial ties with Israel, which is something that we've heard them call for in the past. But now that, you know, they feel like they've overcome this barrier of them passing the resolution, they can maybe focus their attention more on this. And I know Cuyahoga County is something that protesters have been calling for divestments from Israeli bonds, I believe, as well. So I'm sure they'll be focusing more energy towards that.
That would be on the council side. On the mayor's side, there is still a lot of a bad feeling about a tweet that he had put out early on saying essentially that we stand with Israel. And during his State of the City yesterday, twice he was interrupted by protesters, pro-Palestinian protesters, essentially saying that he's siding with genocide.
Right. And I remember when that came out, there was a lot of hurt feelings in the Palestinian community because, in a way, the actions on October 7th were very horrifying and awful and shouldn't have happened. But seeing so much outpouring of support from Cleveland, from the mayor, from like the sports teams for Israeli people and the violence, it made Palestinian Clevelanders feel hurt because they say that their families, their friends in Palestine, they've been being hurt for years by Israeli violence, and no one is ever putting out a statement saying we stand with Palestinians. And so that's kind of where it's been decades of really hurt feelings, a misunderstanding of what's going on in the conflict. And so that's kind of where this stemmed from, was that the protesters say that people were only standing up for Israeli lives and not for Palestinian lives.
Interestingly, after the State of the City, the mayor, in a meeting with reporters, said it's a complicated issue, it's nuanced, there are people, it's essentially the things that you've been hearing city council say until they decided to pass that resolution. And then finally, he did say that, you know, what he hopes for is peace in the Middle East. So that's where he left it, to put a period on that, there were two protesters. Each was escorted out of the facility. Very minimal interruption, and the speech continued. The mayor said he appreciates free speech and actually thanked one of the protesters after he had berated him. All right, moving on. The city of Cleveland has removed concrete barriers from Public Square. The barriers were put in place in 2016 after Republican National Convention when the square was reopened to bus traffic on Superior Avenue, which bisects the green space. They're gone now in time for the NCAA Women's Final Four that's coming up, the big eclipse that's coming April 8th. Glenn, those barriers were really a bad look. I mean, if you're going to put something up, it's like whatever you could find in the house to, you know, to kind of keep the kids out of the kitchen. It was that kind of thing. And finally they're gone, but it's not as though there will be nothing. Eventually, after all this activity we have for the next couple of weeks, there's going to be some construction going on there on bollards.
Yeah, you're going to have some small metal poles, those bollards, and there's also going to be some retractable safety barriers, things that they can kind of move in and out when they need to move things for events. I thought this was an interesting quote. The Jersey barriers, this is from Mayor
That's
Justin
what they call
Bennett.
Them. Those are those concrete barriers.
Yeah.
They're called Jersey barriers.
They were originally intended to protect those that were walking in and around the square from bus and vehicle traffic in the event there was a terrorist attack. That's what Mayor Bibbs said. And I thought that was, you know, that was kind of interesting, just kind of knowing the purpose behind it. But, yeah, they were an eyesore. They were a barrier, obviously. And kind of getting some things in that are movable, that are replaceable, that you can kind of move in and out, seems to make more sense when you need to kind of change the configuration down there for events and whatnot.
The reason those were there was because the city didn't intend to put any barriers up, and
right.
in fact did not intend to have bus traffic go through. The whole idea was this was all one big public walkable green space, and then there was a dispute with the federal government over the route for RTA from federal transportation money. Was not going to come if you didn't allow this bus route to go exactly the way it did. So the buses had to remain. And so Mayor Jackson at the time said, well, we've got to protect the areas because if there's a road there, people could just veer off of it and plow into a crowd. So up goes these ugly barriers, and they stayed for many years.
Many years. And you mentioned, too, this RTA, Regional Transit Authority, issue. India Birdsong Terry is the CEO of Greater Cleveland RTA. She said it's their number one transfer location for buses and trains. 5,000 people board buses every day in and around Public Square. So it is a busy area, and it's a key area for RTA. So, yeah, you did need some protection there, but also you needed some flexibility to be able to kind of move things around and get people moved around as well.
All right. Well, we'll get a good look at what that's going to look like. And again, the construction does not begin until after the eclipse celebration downtown Cleveland, April 8th. So April 9th is when they're going to start working on that other stuff. So should not be disruption. Moving to Akron, city council there unanimously approved an $815 million budget after 2 weeks of negotiations with Mayor Shamas Malik's administration. Abigail, the mayor got a lot of what he wanted, not all of it, though. What changed?
So Malik ended up cutting three new administrative positions that he had proposed in the budget. Some council members had criticized the budget for adding a total of eight new positions. So that was the compromise, axing three of the unfilled roles, which were a data and transparency specialist, a public engagement specialist, and an environmental policy specialist. Malik had argued for these roles, saying that they would help with initiatives around collaboration and transparency, but council members wanted to see that money maybe invested in neighborhoods instead of just putting a bunch of money into the mayor's office. A couple council members said there might yet be hope for these positions, that they might be able to find funds later down the road, but that was the compromise they reached to get this passed.
And interestingly, it was a unanimous vote.
Yeah. I mean, it was unanimous, but there were still some concerns about the increase in positions in the mayor's office and the sustainability of that. Councilmember James Hardy said that he's worried about increases in city property taxes and energy prices and about how the city could long term afford to add these new positions. But he voted for the budget, as did the rest of council.
Public safety staffing is going up?
Yes. So Malik, that was one of the shining points, was that it includes the highest number of police officers and firefighters in decades. And I think maybe even more importantly is that the mayor plans to create new roles focused on retention and recruitment of first responders. So not only adding people to the staff there of those departments, but keeping them. So which is, you know, equally as important, as we've seen the first responder shortage countrywide.
So same as Cleveland, trying to hold on to first responders.
Yeah, it's plaguing everywhere.
And finally, the planning for the city's bicentennial is also in the budget.
Right, yeah. The budget includes $250,000 for the planning of the bicentennial, which is coming up in 2025. And that could be tweaked later, Malik said, depending on what the bicentennial committee ultimately needs.
All right, let's take a quick break right here. When we come back, we're going to round out the round table here on The Sound of Ideas. Stay tuned. Welcome back to the Reporters Roundtable on IdeaStream Public Media. I'm Mike McIntyre with Joe Engels, Glenn Forbes, and Abigail Botar. The American Civil Liberties Union of Ohio has filed suit over House Bill 68, which is scheduled to become law next month. The legislation, it was vetoed originally by Governor Mike DeWine, then overridden by lawmakers, bans gender-affirming medical treatments for transgender youth. It also prohibits transgender girls from taking part in girls' and women's scholastic sports. Joe, what is the ACLU seeking in this lawsuit?
Well, it's seeking a couple of things. First of all, it wants to put this new law on hold. But then it also wants the court to just scrap the law. The law basically, it limits the health care that trans teens can get. And they say that's unconstitutional.
And they file this, is it with the Ohio Supreme Court?
They have. Okay. They filed. No. They have filed this. It's up. It's another court. But I'm a little distracted here. My dogs are barking, if you heard it in the background. But they're seeking to get this turned over. It's not with the Supreme Court. This is filed elsewhere, trying to, because the Ohio Supreme Court, the ACLU says the Ohio Supreme Court, you know, kind of is not the right place for it.
Laws similar to Ohio's have been challenged, too. How did the courts in those states rule?
Well, it depends on who you talk to. Representative Gary Click, the sponsor of the bill, says that, other courts have upheld it. But we've seen actually some mixes. If you look at it, other courts have upheld some parts of it. But if you the ACLU is saying that Ohio has a specific part of its state constitution that voters approved. If you remember, like 20 years ago when Obamacare was a big problem, voters approved a measure that went into an amendment, and it said basically that consumers have healthcare choices. So that plays into it. There are other things that make it different than some of the other things that have been upheld in other courts.
The lawsuit, by the way, was right there where you are in Franklin County Court of Common Pleas.
Right, Franklin County Court.
And the reason I was asking about the Supreme Court is that eventually something like that would make it up through the system of the Supreme Court, and we've seen a change in the Supreme Court's makeup that might raise question about whether the ACLU's suit might ultimately be successful.
Which is exactly why we are seeing such a big, huge battle this fall over the Supreme Court makeup, because the Democrats are saying they want to make sure that they hold what they have and add to it, and the Republicans want to get another Democrat off the court.
Okay. Senator Sherrod Brown, a Democrat, the only statewide elected Democrat in Ohio, joined union steelworkers in Cleveland this week as part of a campaign to halt the sale of U.S. steel to Japan-based Nippon Steel. Nippon announced in December its plans to buy the Pittsburgh-based company for $14 billion. Glenn Brown, who's obviously made his whole career as a pro-labor, pro-union politician, is calling on the White House to block the deal. Why?
It's the dignity of work, Mike. No, that's one of Sherrod Brown's favorite phrases. He says it all the time. Basically, reading between the lines here, Nippon Steel is saying there would be no layoffs, and Sherrod Brown is saying, I don't believe them. That's essentially what's going on here. One of his quotes was, that this, he says, they would ignore the voices of union workers. We can't let a foreign company swoop in and ignore the voices of union workers. He says Nippon has treated workers as a nuisance. So that is why he is looking, he says, to save. He says the sale could affect potentially affect hundreds of jobs. And Nippon could potentially also look at the company's closure of four blast furnaces across the country over the last 4 years. That displaced 6,000 workers. That's from Donnie Blatt. He's the director of the local steel workers union. But again, Nippon Steel previously said there would be no layoffs. So it's kind of like, who do you believe at this point?
Interestingly, the head of Cleveland Cliffs, which is a competitor to U.S. Steel and based here in Cleveland, Lorenzo Gonsalves, has said, and I've seen him on CNBC a lot talking about this, that that deal should not go through. He wants that the president to nix it as well. And in fact, Cleveland Cliffs might have some interest in some of the assets or perhaps purchasing all of U.S. Steel.
Certainly, yeah, and you would certainly think that they would be watching this deal closely, you know, for that reason. But, I mean, he talked a lot about capitalism and the idea of what capitalism should be. He says it's not built to make billionaires, it's built to make the middle class thrive. And he says that's what we're about. So if you look at, you know, the trades, the steel industry, things like that, there certainly is a push to keep this in American hands, under American control, and not allowing a foreign company to come in and kind of do what they want with American workers.
All right, let's talk about getting around Lorain County. Residents there will have access to a new micro transit ride service beginning this summer. Commissioners approved $2.1 million for a pilot program to begin in July and run for a year. Service will be open to people in Elyria and Lorain. Interesting, Abigail, it's basically like really cheap Uber.
Yeah.
But Uber pool.
Right, yeah. So riders can schedule affordable on-demand rides through an app like Uber or by calling, which is like similar to like a dial-a-ride. And the program uses smaller vehicles, which they say will reach areas where large fixed-route buses can't efficiently serve those areas. And yeah, you're going to be using like software that like shows where people are asking for the rides, and so they can pick them up on the route and, and
yeah, that's
take
one
them
of the
where
whole,
they need to go.
One of the whole deals is it's $2 for a ride.
Right.
A dollar for a senior. And if you want to ride, though, it's not, you don't get to ride all by yourself. We're going to map it, and when people are on the way, we'll pick them up, and when the car is full, we'll get to where we need to go. Mm-hmm. It's interesting because what they're trying to deal with here, and we see it in the RTA in Cuyahoga County as well, is that the buses don't always go exactly where people need to go. And if you don't have a car and the bus route is 6 miles away from the spot where you want to go to work or need to make a doctor's visit, how do you get there? This is an idea of saying it's basically like a bus, but when they say small vehicle, they mean a car, can pick you up and bring you directly there.
Yeah. It plagues everywhere. I mean, Lake County, Lake Tran, they have people that are, working in industries that can't get there if they were riding the bus. It happens in Summit County. Summit County just redid their bus routes, so we got some near where I live, but they don't really take you anywhere. So we have bus routes, but they're not, like, helpful routes to get to places where there's jobs or restaurants, right, or anywhere you'd really want to go. So I think this is a really interesting model. I'm interested to see how it turns out.
And Glenn, if you're working at a job and you're making $15 an hour, you can't afford the $45 Uber to get there.
Right.
So this is something that's supposed to help not only workers, if you're paying a couple of bucks to do it, but it'll help employers as well.
Yeah, we talk about barriers to work, barriers to care, you know, things like that, and that's kind of the idea here. The other interesting thing is, you know, this is a smart app, if you will, so they can create kind of these algorithms, right? They can change up the routes if they find that one route is more popular than the other. They can kind of make things more nimble and kind of move things around a little bit. And in fact, according to the release, these algorithms can also create quicker and efficient trips. You know, they can match riders headed in the same direction. So rather than waiting 2 hours for a bus, you're waiting 15, 20 minutes for this smart ride service to come pick you up and get everybody to where they're going. So it is an interesting idea, and I'm also interested to see how it turns out.
All right, real quick on this one. Arnold Schwarzenegger told his podcast listeners this week he's doing great after surgery at the Cleveland Clinic. He's 76. He had a pacemaker implanted March 18th. He has a genetic heart condition that's required procedures over the years. But interestingly, I did not see him. I thought maybe he'd be somewhere around downtown.
Or he'd stop by?
Right, yeah, after stop by.
Come in for a tour?
Say hello. But it's funny. He even made the joke himself. He's like, the Terminator is like, you know, sort of becoming more machine.
Yes, he can't help himself.
He cannot help himself. Anyway, he also encouraged men to take care of themselves. Pretty powerful coming from one of the biggest action stars of all time, but a big Cleveland mention by Arnold Schwarzenegger, who's also in the news in Ohio, as we've mentioned before, because he has been very vocal about gerrymandering and ending gerrymandering and getting politicians out of that process. Joe, it's been great to have you today. Appreciate your being here.
Thanks for having me.
All right. And good to have you as well, Abigail and Glenn. And Abigail, maybe you'll have some thoughts about it being Beyonce fan day today.
Oh, I do like Beyonce, but I'm not like the...
You're not in the beehive?
You're part of the
beehive. No, I'm like an outside enjoyer. I'm not a part of it, but I enjoy the fans and I enjoy her.
Well, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame is celebrating Beyonce fan day today, coinciding with her new country album, Act Two, Cowboy Carter. It comes out today. Rock Hall event will feature some artifacts from Beyonce, a collection of her videos. It'll be playing in the Foster Theater. And so we're going to leave you today with 16 Carriages from Beyonce's new country album.
16 carriages driving away while I watch them ride with my fears away into the summer sunset on a holy night on a long back road. All the tears I fight. 16 carriages.
To get the last word on today's topic, send an email to soi@ideastream.org. We're on Twitter, now X, at Sound of Ideas. Monday on the Sound of Ideas, we'll bring you our recent conversation on the new class of drugs, including Ozempic, that are being used for weight loss. If you missed any part of this program, find us online or listen to the Sound of Ideas podcast, which you can get on any podcast app. You can also hear a rebroadcast tonight at 9 on 89.7 WKSU. And check out the television version, Ideas, tonight at 7:30 on WVIZ PBS. I'm Mike McIntyre. Thank you so much for listening, and stay safe.
They won't dim my light. All these years I fight. It's been 38 summers, and I'm riding my bed on the back of the bus in a bunk with the band. Going so hard, now I miss my...